Chapter 17. The winds turned variable and shifted us about, sending our little boat skidding for a few hours in one direction. Then, likely as not, it would turn on the opposite tack and make an equal distance the other way. It was irritating to be losing time in this way, for each passing hour that we were not heading the way we wanted to go was, in the most literal sense, an hour taken away from our lives. Finally, a steady breeze held us in the northwest. This was worse, for it drove us back eastward about 100 miles, the same distance that we had so laboriously paddled to the west. This contrary wind worked us about 50 miles to the south as well. We were becoming discouraged when another flat calm descended. We took up our shoe paddles and rowed back westward for 8 hours straight before the wind set in from the east and took us westward again. Now I discovered how I had unconsciously miscalculated my position on our chart, in my anxiety to work westward. About this time we passed through the spot where I thought a large inhabited island should be. Actually, we were about 100 miles east of this island, I later learned. The fallibility of my chart was a setback. I tried to console myself with the reflection that such an error was to be expected under the circumstances, especially since I had no navigation instruments except the little mileage scale. Nevertheless, finding that I couldn't tell exactly where I was gave me a disquieting feeling. I couldn't communicate my disappointment to the boys, but concentrated rather on buoying up my own confidence. "Dixon," I said to myself, "if you get discouraged..." I didn't finish the thought, but resolutely put it out of my mind and turned to our immediate concerns. The raft was still in good condition. Our gear was holding up well, what was left of it, except that the water-catching rags were becoming frayed. The two lads had lost their socks, and their feet were painfully sunburned. My own socks were full of holes and almost rotting from the sun and salt water, but still gave my feet some protection. Of us three, Gene Aldrich suffered the most from sunburn, partly as a result of his own stubbornness, or carelessness, in not heeding my advice to keep rags about his head. I frequently advised both the boys to keep their heads covered as well as they could against the sun, but Gene preferred to let himself burn. As a consequence, he was always suffering and complained incessantly. His nose and face particularly burned and peeled time after time. He just couldn't tan. With his fiery red face and thin fringe of youthful beard, he looked like one of those spider monkeys I used to laugh at in the zoo. I sympathized with his pain, but he was the funniest-looking human being I have ever seen. Tony's darker skin tanned fairly well, so he didn't suffer so much. His lips, however, were continuing to give him trouble. I finally got him over the habit of sucking the blood out of them, as I convinced him that by doing this he was literally sucking out his own strength. My own skin was the swarthiest of all, but much as I tanned, a particularly hot day would take off my hide like scales from a baked fish. Our only relief was to bail water over each other. This was cooling, but the salt on our raw red skin caused hours of torment. For the first time now, I became conscious of bodily weakness. That first long, hard session of rowing left us all fagged for 3 days. We were just beginning to regain our strength when we again took up the paddles for 8 straight hours. After that, we were never so strong as before. We lost flesh rapidly from this time onward. It was not long before our bones were sticking out like red glazed knobs. The sun was beginning to have its effect on our minds, too. I noticed this first in myself as a shortness of temper. I became annoyed at the boys over little things that I wouldn't have noticed had I been normal. I became particularly irritated at Gene. I would ask him a question or tell him to do something, and instead of answering me, he would continue to stare straight ahead as if he had not heard. It was impossible to tell whether he was lost in thought or just slipping into a doze. Then I would fly into a violent rage and scream at him. After a minute or two of this, I would stop to catch my failing breath, and usually some little sound like the lapping of a wave against the raft or the forlorn squawk of a seabird would recall me to my senses. At first I apologized to Gene for my unreasoned outburst, but when I saw that he was not listening, I lapsed into morose silence myself. Eventually Gene would snap out of his trance and become talkative, but his conversation wandered. He would begin an anecdote, and before he had completed his thought he would be on a different subject. When I considered Gene's condition during my own lucid moments, it occurred to me that the strangest phase of his behavior was the fact that he sometimes was the sanest of us all. His spells of absent-mindedness came intermittently and without warning. As I look back, I see that my own reaction to the starvation, thirst, confinement, and heat was no less unreasonable. One moment I would be solicitous and concerned for the boys. Without warning, my mood would give way to blind anger. At such times, I couldn't understand why they did not jump to obey the instant I gave an order. Then I would curse irrationally, as one swears at a stone after he has stubbed his toe on it. Tony's reactions came to be about the same as mine. Until the third week, he was terribly despondent. After that, his staunch nature came to life. Tony had a heritage of warm blood. As privation began to work on him, as it did on us all, he showed it in shortness of temper. Sometimes, when we all happened to be in a jolly mood at the same time, I jokingly congratulated him on the vocabulary he could show when his ire was aroused. Tony would grin at this, a little sheepishly. Ordinarily, he had a sweet, shy nature that shrank from violence either of action or of language. "Well, I never liked to fight when I was a kid," Tony explained once. "But one time a fella got me cornered, and I guess I beat the hell out of him." I reflected that it was good to have these lads along. They were young, they were inexperienced with the sea, which had been my profession for 22 years. They were just two American boys, neither with any extraordinary advantages. One was from a farm, the other was the son of an immigrant. They joined the colors to fight a war which neither had any particular equipment for, and one day they found themselves up in the air, hunting submarines with a tough old chief petty officer. And now here they were, 3 weeks in a little rubber float that turned them like birds on a spit beneath a flame every rainless day. In that time, the food and water we put into our bellies would hardly have sustained, for the same length of time, the poor creatures we had eaten. Still, beside me here, they were stubbornly fighting off a death that must become more certain and more horrible every day that we avoided it. No one yet had suggested the easy way out. If anyone thought of it, he didn't let on. "Back in Missouri," Jean said, "the peach trees bloom swell." "I wonder how Irene's getting along," Tony mused. Irene was Tony's girl back in Youngstown. They planned to marry when the war was over and Tony was out of the Navy. I considered briefly the topics before the house, peach trees in Missouri and Tony's girl in Youngstown. I decided that I would rather hear about anything other than peaches. We had had Missouri peaches for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for a week now. "She sounds like a pretty intelligent girl, Tony," I said. "Yeah, she works for a doctor now, and she's anxious to get into some kind of war work, Red Cross or something like that." So we talked about Irene for a while, and indeed she must be a fine girl. Later, Tony showed me some of the poetry she wrote. Jean was on watch and not taking much part in the conversation, since I had dodged his favorite subject. I was sitting in the bottom of the boat. Tony was lying down. It was getting to be about that time of day when the equatorial sun seemed to take on a positive malevolence, drying up our spirits and making the mere effort of talking an exertion to be avoided if possible. Suddenly, Tony sat up. "I feel a coconut," he said. Jean and I watched him stupidly. "I feel a coconut?" The statement didn't make any sense. Was Tony imagining things? "Didn't you hear me? I felt a coconut bump me under the bottom of the boat." That was different. I jumped up and looked over the side. Sure enough, there was a coconut bobbing just out of reach in the water. "Get it," Jean said. The water-soaked shell looked slick, so I didn't try to grab it. Instead, I dived over the side, caught the nut, and heaved it back into the raft. The boys put the nut down carefully and helped me back aboard. "I felt something bump me on the back, see?" Tony said, elated. "And the first thing I thought of was a coconut." The thick, fibrous outer husk had begun to rot. Evidently, the coconut had been in water a long time. However, the shell was still intact. It acted as a float, and at the same time kept most of the salt water from the nut itself, which reposed snugly within. Soaked as it was, the outer shell was easy to remove. I pulled it off, a strip at a time, with the pliers. Then I took a piece of metal from the defunct pistol and punched a hole in the eye. First, I tasted the milk inside to see if it was fit to drink. It was a little brackish, but not too bad. I passed the nut around, and each of us took a turn until the milk was all gone. Warm and brackish as it was, the drink was refreshing after our long diet of nothing. After we drank the milk, we cracked the nut open and divided it. The meat made a fairly substantial meal by our easy standards. It was particularly fortunate that we had come upon a coconut, for our systems needed oil. 21 days in the sun of the tropics had boiled the moisture from our bodies, and our skins were dry as parchment. I felt as if I had been flayed.